Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I'm really excited because we have a very special guest today. Eddie Zook is the Chief Operating Officer for OFA and one of the masterminds behind the Canine Health Information Center, so as well as a very famous beagle guy. So I think we're going to have a great talk with Eddie. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Laura. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. So give us the 411. Tell us how you started in dogs and what kind of brought you to where you are today, which is a sort of exalted position at board.
Okay, I'll try. I guess my beginning in dogs is sort of like many other people. I was not born into a dog family per se, although my entire family was basically obsessed animal lovers and so forth. But my father was actually in the service and we were stationed in Germany. And I grew up over there from kindergarten through fifth grade. And when that tour was over, he was transferred to Fort Ritchie, which is in Maryland. And we moved to a town called Hagerstown. And as it turned out, and I guess this is sort of the fate part, the local Mason-Dixon Kennel Club in Hagerstown held their annual dog shows at the fairgrounds there. And the fairgrounds were an easy bike ride within my home. And they also held weekly training classes in the parking lot of our local grocery store there, where they did both confirmation and obedience classes. Nice. And so once a week, I would go and faithfully, you know, watch all these beautiful dogs, even though I didn't have a dog going through the program, and basically gained in the courage and so forth and went up and started talking to people and actually ended up joining the kennel club there before I even had a purebred dog.
Wow.
And got to meet one of the ladies in the kennel club. Her name was Mary Cease, and she was a very successful beagle breeder at the time. This is probably 1976 or so, I'm going to guess, around 76. And Mary was doing quite well. Her kennel name was Hollyhocks. And she didn't have any puppies coming up at the time, but she did help me find a beagle. And I ended up getting a male from a breeder up in New Hampshire who was from a beautifully bred dog from Kings Creek, which of course was Mike Billings, her kennel name from Kings Creek, and Colgren Bloodlines. And so I got this first dog, again, 76, I think, and finished him myself as a young owner handler within just a few months of starting to show. And where are we? That was 40 years ago, and I've never been without a beagle since.
You were hooked, man.
Big time.
That's awesome. So talk about some of those mentors from Hagerstown Kennel Club. Did you have the opportunity to, Michelle, see some of that?
Yeah. So Mike at that time, of course, was no longer breeding dogs. She was already well on her way to becoming an all-rounder. But in addition to Mary, I was very lucky that I had a number of really high-profile people within the beagle world on the East Coast for some whatever lucky reason took an interest in me and took me under their wing. And so people like Jack White, who later, of course, became an AKC field rep. Jack was very influential in my early years, as was Ralph Alderfer, who had Pinoak Beagles, and Nadine Chicoin, who had Daisy Run Beagles. So again, I was very lucky between Mary and Jack and Ralph and Nadine. I had a great, great foundation to learn the breed.
Absolutely. And so with some of these incredible beagle people behind you as mentors, what advice that they gave you as your mentors, what stands out for you? What do you still runs through your head today?
Well, I think probably each of them had a different set of different things that they were truly expert at. Ralph was a great handler and also a wonderful trimmer. So I went accompanied Ralph to lots of dog shows, and I think he really taught me the importance of and some of the skills of handling and trimming. Nadine, conversely, was very lucky. A lot of times Nadine and her family would go on vacation, and I would end up dog sitting for them. And so I think from Nadine, I really learned the importance of how to care for your animals and so forth. Jack, of course, Jack was a jack of all trades, if you will. So he was good in that aspect. And then in addition to just the beagle people, I was lucky that because I was so hooked and became pretty successful in juniors, I think like a lot of people, I ended up being one of those juniors that traveled with handlers and assisted handlers and so forth. And that became a regular part of my youth. And actually, even once I finished college and was often working weekends, I would still be helping people. because it's what I loved and it's what I enjoyed.
And so who were your handlers that you...
I was probably the last of the bunch, believe it or not, that worked for Bob and Janie Forsythe.
Yes.
So I was road help for Bob and Janie for quite some time. I did a lot of traveling to dog shows just because she lived fairly nearby with Karen Ash, who's a judge now and who at the time bred and showed pointers. Then my first actual summer job was at Dasson Farm for Bud Dickey and Joseph Rugnetti.
Yes.
And when you get immersed into caring for 100 plus poodles, you know, that's
poodle.
That's quite...
Yeah. Beagles look really good at that point.
Yeah, that's quite the learning experience. And then finally, I ended up Tom and Andrick Lassford, and I spent 3 summers there. And basically, even once I finished school and so forth, they became like a second family to me. So up until the point in time when they actually retired from handling, we were still traveling to dog shows together.
And that is what a wide and varied perspective on the dog that you acquire.
Absolutely. It was great.
Incredible. So from this background, you went to college, you got a job. What brought you between those things to the OFA, which is, I'm not sure if the OFA or the Best in Show Beagles, which one is your most famous piece?
Yeah, well, certainly none of that was planned. So when I finished school, I went to work for a company called EDS, which was Electronic Data Systems, which at the time was still owned and the president was Ross Perot, who a lot of people will remember.
Yes.
Ross. And and if you remember Ross and his presidential campaign, that's exactly the way he ran EDS too. It was very, very much run sort of like in a military kind of fashion. But if you like that environment, it was very conducive towards cultivating your own skills and your success. So I was with EDS actually for 16 years, and I was doing the typical proverbial climbing up the corporate ladder and was doing quite well. And I had no intention. I thought it was going to be the place I would be pretty much my entire career. And out of the blue, I got a call from an executive recruiting firm, and how they got my name, I'm not really sure, but they advised me of a potential opportunity that was coming up, and my name had been suggested to them. And so at first, they wouldn't even tell me what the organization was. They explained that it was dog-related, sort of had a health component to it, certainly piqued my interest. I began the interview process, and of course, about partway through, I figured out that it was with the OFA, and obviously then after several interviews, they said, this is for the executive director position at the OFA. So that was actually quite a lengthy thing. It went on for several months, and it involved numerous sort of phone interviews, several in-person interviews, and so forth. And it actually got to the point where I was given the offer. And even at that point, I wasn't 100% sure I was going to take it, because I was still, you know, sure, I'll talk to you. We'll see what happens. And but when the offer actually came in, I realized that the opportunity to apply my business background and my dog knowledge and expertise in a dog-related field where dogs could benefit and I could come to work every day and it would be dog-related, that was something I could not turn down. And so I've been with the OFA now for 16 years. So 16 years at EDS and now 16 years with the OFA.
Clearly, OFA has, I've watched it in the 16 I've been there, ramp up and reach out to more and breeds, to issues, to more and more databases. And with that came the creation of CHIC. And talk a little bit about your involvement, that development of that project.
Okay. So I'll give you sort of a two-part answer. The first thing that you sort of mentioned was reaching out to other things and so forth. And I think that's sort of indicative of when the organization was founded back in 66. It was all about hips. And the name of the organization was the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals.
Right.
And over the course of the years, because we are doing so many other things, I think that's really why we've made a concerted effort to refer to ourselves as the OFA, just like General Motors became GM and Kentucky Fried Chicken became KFC,
right,
because we do so much more than orthopedic things now. So again, the OFA is much more than hips, elbows. It involves a lot more than just orthopedic issues. In terms of the CHIC program, again, the timing was sort of maybe one of those fate kind of things. The CHIC program, even though it wasn't even named that at the time, was sort of conceptualized within the delegate body, specifically the Canine Health Committee, which at the time was run by Shelley Adler, who was a giant schnauzer breeder from Florida, and Bob Kelly, who was, you know, formerly on the AKC board of directors. So that whole concept of a centralized database that incorporated as much health data as possible was conceived there, and they in turn approached the OFA. The OFA was sort of the logical extension or organization to take the project on. The OFA agreed to it, and again, it was sort of that fate comes into play that was right around the time that I ended up joining the OFA. So I was very lucky that I was able to be here for the inception of CHIC and basically lead it from that idea concept through the initial pilot breeds to the full implementation to where we are today, which is, I think, 150 or so breeds that are participating in the program. Over 100,000 dogs have earned their CHIC numbers for health screening in accordance with their breed recommended criteria. So we've come a long way in that time, and I think we've hopefully done a good job for promoting canine health. The CHIC program in and of itself, we try and emphasize the fact that it's not an award program,
right,
and it's not a stamp of approval for breeding, right?
Right.
It is purely...
Thank you. I was going to ask you these questions, so you're doing good.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about promoting and encouraging health testing and awareness. It's not about normalcy, so dogs who have abnormal results can still get a CHIC number. The key piece there is that the owners must be willing to share that information, place all those results in the public domain, disclose them so that everybody can see them and everybody can benefit from them and make more informed breeding decisions in order to breed healthier dogs. You know, if you're going to, you've experienced this, I can certainly say this for myself. If you're going to do this long enough, 40 years is a long time. If you breed dogs for long enough, you will produce an animal, whether you intended for it or not, you will produce animals that have some type of inherited disease.
Absolutely.
And does that make you a bad breeder or a bad person? Absolutely not. But it's what are you doing up front to try and minimize the occurrence of the disease? And what are you doing after the fact when you learn from those errors to try and mitigate the risk of future disease? And that's what begins to set you apart as sort of the responsible, health-conscious breeder, as opposed to those that are just doing it for the almighty buck or chasing awards and ribbons or whatever their motivation might be.
And I think I was actually president of my national club when the CHIC requirement came online, right? So I was involved with the entire process of taking my club through doing the health survey and getting the committee put together and creating parent club approved health testing recommendation to be included. So I kind of went along through this journey with you.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you raised, Laura, is really important, and that's that the critical piece of the parent club involvement.
Yes.
So I'm a beagle guy, and I've got a lot of expertise when it comes to my breed, but I would never be so bold as to assume that I know what is best for a German wirehair pointer breeder,
yes, yes,
or a Labrador breeder, etc. And I think in general, everybody here at the OFA would take that same position. So in the course of the program, it's really important that the OFA or CHIC or the Canine Health Foundation, which, by the way, I need to give them credit because the CHIC program is co-sponsored and co-administered, if you will, by the American Kennel Club Canine Health Foundation along with the OFA. But neither organization would be so bold as to dictate to your parent club what we believe the testing for your breed should be. So you as a parent club, all the parent clubs that are participating, they enter the program voluntarily and they make the suggestions what they believe testing criteria for their breed should be. And I would say probably in, I don't know an exact percentage, but 98-99% of the time, we have gone with exactly what the parent club has come into the door with and recommended. There have been a handful of times where we've gone back to the parent club and made some recommendations. Maybe you're requiring a little too much or you're being a little too stringent, or this particular disease you want people to test for. Maybe the testing protocol isn't thoroughly fleshed out or something like that. But in the vast majority of cases, and hopefully your own parent club, since you raised
Absolutely.
That as an example, we ended up going with exactly what you guys proposed.
You did indeed. And actually, one of the things that I found very valuable for my parent club is that we created this, everybody on the health committee, basically each person picked their own disease, if you want to pay this, how that boiled down to, but kind of. And one of the recommendations, von Willebrand's disease, we ran 5 years worth of testing, not a single dog came back as affected. The parent club made the decision within their health committee to make that then an optional test and to in the cardiac test to required rather than optional. So I loved that ability for the parent club to have flexibility ability as they're developed, as they learn more about their breed's health.
And again, you raise, you're doing a great job leading me into some discussion here. And that's that the program is not static. And right. that we know that, again, you guys came to the table and you made a recommendation. But over the course of time, you realized that, hey, maybe that wasn't exactly what's in our breed's best interest, or maybe we could do something different. So we are certainly always willing to work with parent clubs in terms of making changes, adding a requirement, perhaps deleting a requirement as new DNA tests become available, adding them as optional items and so forth. So again, we don't want the requirements for the breed to change every year, but we are certainly flexible about over the course of time, allowing them to evolve so that they maintain pace with whatever the current concerns are.
Absolutely. And I loved that. I talk a little bit, and certainly I have my own personal interaction with this, what I've observed within my own breed club, but you're going to have a much broader view on this. I'd love to hear about how this system, this basic concept of test and tell, this transparency, this putting the information out there so everyone has access to it, how is that changing the world of purebred dog breeding in your view?
Okay, well, a couple of things. First of all, it's not an easy thing to quantify or measure. So
right.
on the various OFA application forms, of course, we do have what we call an authorization to release abnormal results block. What I will say is that over the course of the years that I've been here, we've seen that go from virtually nobody initialing that block to, believe it or not, today about 30% of our applications come in with that block initial. Now, you also need to take into consideration what the disease is that the person is willing to release. It's a whole lot easier to come to the door or come to the table up front and say, you know what, my dog's hypothyroid, make that available. That there's a lot less stigma with something like that than there might be with saying my dog has grade 3 elbow dysplasia, right? So it sort of depends upon what the severity of the disease is, how that disease affects quality of life. It affects what the culture is within in the breed. We can look at, there are certain breeds where the overall culture is such that if you don't participate in health testing, you're a pariah. And if you're unwilling to share the results, you're a pariah, right? And I use that word pariah, but it's really, it shouldn't be taken negatively, because basically you've got a people that are fanatic about the health of their breed and are really adamant that they're trying to improve things, right? And because of that, they're willing to share information amongst themselves, make sure that there are no witch hunts, share information, and make more informed breeding decisions. We all know that there are other breeds out there where the culture is much different, and secrecy often, unfortunately, takes precedence over sharing of information. And the bottom line is, if we care about the breed and we want to see health improve, you have to be willing to share that information. If everybody sweeps it under carpet, keeps it secret, doesn't disclose, you will never make fast enough progress. So anybody that complains about the protocols that are out there, whether it's OFA or Penn Hip or British scheme or the way we do cardiac evaluations, anybody that throws negativity in there and says that we're not making improvement, you know what? All our improvement is dependent upon how much people are willing to share. So if you can breed, not only breed four normals, which the OFA provides you a great database tool to select for normalcy, but if you can add into that equation and apply genetic pressure to breed against abnormals, you're going to make much faster progress. And the only way that you can apply some selective genetic pressure to breed away from abnormals is to know where they are.
Exactly. And I think just like personal testimonial, right, involvement with my own personal breed club, people that historically didn't test, frankly, much at all, or if they did, they didn't talk about it, or they might have talked about it sort of in a whisper behind their hands. Our club is one that meets that first criteria you talked about. Peer pressure has become your only tool if you're getting a chick number. And what are you doing breeding that dog without a chick number? And that, I think, is so powerful, that peer pressure for good, you know?
Yeah. You know what? I don't know about you, but in beagles are, when, you know, I breed a litter, beagles are really hard to place in show homes. There's just not that much demand out there. So the vast majority of puppies end up in pet homes as somebody's companion. And a lot of those might be beautiful dogs that are perfectly finishable and easy champions, but that's just the way things are. And I would imagine that the great amount of dogs, it's the minority that end up in the show ring. It's the minority that end up actually contributing to the next generation in our gene pools and so forth. The majority of dogs become somebody's pet. And you know what? If you ask those people when they're getting the dog, what's the most important thing thing that they're looking for, you know, they don't care about that dog's tail set.
You know? No, they don't.
They don't care about how much stop the dog has or if it's a little, if its pasterns are a little weak or any of that. They want a dog that's going to be a happy, healthy, long-lived, faithful companion to their family. And we owe it to those people as breeders to do the best we can to give them a healthy puppy.
Preaching to the choir. I love it. That is so...
Amen.
Amen. It really is critical. So what are your goals? Okay, so we're here, and I think you guys have really accomplished an amazing amount. Now, Chick, the official launch was...
Back in 2001, shortly after I started.
Okay, okay. That's what I was wondering. So in essentially 15 years, you've really accomplished a lot. And so what are your goals, you know, going forward? Where do you see this going?
Well, I think the Chick program, in all honesty, has reached a level of maturity. So it's with Chick, we're not so much anymore at that point where we're saying we are trying to recruit these breeds or do this, that with it. I think I would make the generalizations to say, what are your goals, where you're going? Some immediate things. There's a lot of technology out there that I don't think we're taking advantage of adequately. So there are things that we're looking at the OFA in terms of embracing newer technology and so forth. And unfortunately, it's difficult because you're not only dealing with things internally, but it impacts basically every single practicing veterinarian who's doing exams. So as an example, we've been beating our heads against the wall trying to figure out a better way of capturing eye exam data. And we've gone through some different beta testing and so forth, trying to do things through electronic apps and so forth. But the difficulty we've encountered is so many eye exams are done off-site. So the vast majority of them, at least for us show breeders, are done off-site at a fairgrounds during a dog show where maybe there's internet connectivity, maybe there's not, right? And so we've tried a lot of different things and just had a really hard time making those work. So we're, in terms of goals, we're looking at a lot of things like that in terms of technology to let the cat out of the bag by the time this airs. Probably, hopefully it'll be implemented, but we have brand new redesigned website that is in the very, very final stages of beta testing that will hopefully be live within the next month, certainly.
Breaking news so here at Pure Dog Talk.
There are things like that. Then there are other things like, and these are very, it sounds easy, but it's not. There are things like, if you look at certain breeds and you say, what are your concerns? You can look at a lot of the brachycephalic breeds, and their biggest concern are airway syndrome problems, right? And so the OFA, we don't really address that. And so we do have a tracheal hypoplasia database that's in place for Frenchies and Bulldogs, but we're actively working with some leading veterinary experts in terms of what could we do in terms of trying to measure nary's openings and so forth.
Long
and
soft palate.
Exactly. So
speaking,
you know,
as a
all
pug
those,
person, that you know, we have bugs here. Long soft palates. I'd love to know more about that.
So we're certainly not ever thinking that we've got it all addressed. So we are continuously trying to look at new things. What new databases can we add? In the case of new databases that we do add, are they ones where we need to actually develop exam protocols? If we're developing exam protocols, we need to make sure that the owners down the road are ensured that these are not just arbitrary things that we're coming up internally here at the office or with the OFA Board of Directors, but that we truly are involving experts within the veterinary community where this is their particular area of expertise. So again, we're not done.
Right.
We've got,
Right. That's great stuff. That is very cool stuff. So we're going to switch gears here a little bit. We're going to change hats. Okay.
Okay.
From medical stuff to beagle stuff.
Alrighty. My favorite topic.
I know, right? So let's talk about having a piece two different Westminster Kennel Club Best in Show. I mean, how did you come to be involved with those dogs? I mean, that's pretty amazing.
There's probably times when I still can't believe it myself. And the reason I know it every day to be true is that those two giant rosettes are hanging side by side in my home. And I look at them every day. And I've got the two pictures on the mantle of my fireplace. And I see those every day. So I know that it really did happen. Again, it's kind of interesting. I had always shown my own dogs with a fair amount of success. With these two dogs, it was a little bit different. I did not breed either one of them, but both Uno and Miss P, a number of my dogs figure very prominently in their pedigrees. And I'm one of these guys that I'm a big enough person to admire and admit and recognize outstanding traits in other people's dogs. But I'm also one of those people that I've got this weird appreciation for family. So even though I didn't breed these guys and they weren't tightly line bred, I consider considered them from the first time I saw them as family because they have a number of my dogs back in their pedigrees. Both dogs were ones where I saw them as young, sort of 6-month-old range puppies. And both of them are ones where I looked at them, I fell in love. I totally believed from day one in their quality, in the fact that they were outstanding representatives of our breed. And I knew that I was going to do whatever I could, coerce, bribe.
Beg, borrow, and steal, yes.
Beg, borrow, and steal to become a part of those dogs and their careers and what they were able to accomplish. And in both cases, I was successful. And both dogs are a dream come true. They're both, I love them both.
Without doubt. How could you not? Come on. Okay, so Uno, pretty sure I was there. I might not have been this Pete. Uno was kind of an odds-on favorite, right? I mean, like, he came in thinking, yeah, this could happen. Miss P seemed to have come from outer space.
Miss P's win did surprise us all I'll let you know how much it surprised us. So I was actually in Germany at a conference, and I missed the Dogs in Review Purina, you know, Old Quaker Oats Awards, right, which she won. I was unable to be there for that. I was at the conference on Saturday and Sunday. I got on a plane on Monday morning, and as soon as the plane touched down at JFK, I turned my phone on and I was looking for results. Did we win the breed? Because I didn't know. Right. So I saw that we won the breed. I got all excited, ran, got downtown, got changed, got checked in the hotel, got my suit on, went over the garden and watched her win the group. Now, the next irony is that's Monday night. On Wednesday morning, I was due to give a presentation at the Western Veterinary Conference in Las Vegas because I certainly didn't plan on having to stay in New York for Best in Show. And it's, you know, one of those things, for better or for worse, I take my job very seriously, and that was a priority. And so on Tuesday morning, I got on a plane from New York out to Vegas, went, got checked into the hotel in Vegas, got there basically just in time to turn on the TV, and I watched it. How pathetic and sad is this? I watched it literally in my hotel room by myself.
Oh, that could make me cry. Yeah.
And so then when she won, obviously my phone started going crazy and I'm jumping up and down by myself like a lunatic screaming. And my dear, dear friends, Susan Hamill and her husband, John Hamill, were also at the same hotel. We were all attending the same conference the next day. And so we went down to the bar of the hotel and the three of us had my big Best in Show celebration.
Oh my gosh. But that's painful.
Yes, it was absolutely a surprise.
Very cool. And so you talk about being showed your own dog, and we hear an awful lot perception popular. Can't success. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, there's some schools of thought there. I guess my own personal experience would be that you absolutely can compete with your own dogs. So as a 14-year-old kid, I'm competing against all these experienced people, and I finished my first champion in just a few months. I bred my first litter and had my first multiple group winner from that first litter as now a 17-year-old, whatever, owner-handler.
Because nobody told you you couldn't.
Because nobody told me I couldn't. With Judy, who was, of course, Lanber Miss Fleetwood, we went out there, and at the time I had two dogs. I mean, you would have thought I was just your average pet person. I went to work every day. I had two dogs at home, a dog named Chevy and his daughter Judy, and every weekend, you know, came 5 o'clock on Friday, we went and we packed our car and went off to the dog show, and we ended up, she won 40 Best in Shows. She won 3 national specialties, 3 consecutive Westminster Kennel Club group placements, became the top winning 13-inch beagle of all time. And we were literally just a boy and his dog going off on weekends. And so it can be done. Now, all that said, things are different nowadays. And I don't know that I so much mean in terms of that the owner handler can't compete, because I think an owner handler that knows what they're doing, that has a good dog, can in fact compete. I think where it's tougher is in terms of chasing records and points and rankings. There is no way. I don't know how we accomplished that. I look back on that, those years showing my own dog. I don't know how we got some of the records we did, because we basically went to dog shows on Saturday and Sunday and an occasional Friday. And I mean,
but you're talking about back in the 80s, right, Eddie?
Yeah. So, you know, it was different. And then the other thing that I would qualify is, you got to remember too, that while I'd learned a lot from my time with Tom and Andrea and working for people like the Forsythes and Buddy and Joseph and so forth, at the end of the day, you got to remember too, I was showing a beagle, right?
Right.
And so being an owner handler with a beagle is probably a lot different than, say, being an owner handler with a poodle,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the expertise that a train takes to present and do something, that difficulty, or being an owner handler with one of the broken coated terrier breeds, any of the things that require true, true lifelong expertise in trimming and so forth. In that, you know, in that sense, the owner owner handler, realistically, they probably are at a bit of a disadvantage.
Simply due to the number of hours in a given day.
You got it.
Right. Okay, so what's your best, give me three best recommendations for the, we have a lot of folks that listen who are new, who are sort of just getting started. What are your best, three best recommendations for them?
Okay, you didn't put this on the advanced question list. So
I did, it's right at the bottom.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well, right off the bat, I think I would say, realize that this is a journey. And a lot of people say it, and hopefully it's not a cliche. I know it's not for me, but after 40 years in dogs, I certainly never think of myself as knowing at all. Every dog show is an opportunity to learn something new about a different breed, about grooming, training, trimming, judging, whatever the case may be. Every day is an opportunity to learn. So embrace that and keep on learning, no matter whether you've been in it 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. Another cliche, but you know what? It's so true, is when people say at the end of the day, you're taking home the best dog. Well, you may not be taking home the winner, but love your dog. If you don't love your dog, how can you put the time and effort and all that you need to put into it to be successful at dog shows? So you need to do it because you love your dog, because you love spending time with your dog, because you love interacting with your dog. If you're doing it for other reasons, it's probably the wrong reasons, and I doubt that you're going to achieve the level of success you will. So always be willing to continue to learn. Always remember to embrace and love your animals. I don't know about a third one, I guess.
Those two are pretty important, Eddie.
They're pretty important.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, again, sort of one of those cliches, but I chuckle to myself when people say, why are you judging? And people say, well, I want to give back. Well, to me, that's kind of a cliche too. You know what? How much are you that narcissistic that you think sharing your knowledge is so important to have to give back? So, but I think there are a lot of things that we can do to give back to the sport. And judging is a part of that. I think it's really important to belong to clubs and be active in your club. If nobody's willing to do that work, there's going to be no dog shows.
Yep.
So be willing to work and give back. Be willing to always embrace learning. And at the end of the day, remember why you're doing it, because we love our dogs.
Excellent. Eddie, thank you so much. I know you're a busy, busy guy and you've got to run to class
for
your pet.
Class,
I know. Yep. I love that. Absolutely love that. You have a great day and very best wishes.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.